Tonight on Arena, Helena Bonham Carter on her new movie Four Letters of Love, and Enda Walsh is back in Galway with The Baby's Room, the latest in the long-running Room series. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. It was the Irish book that broke millions of hearts around the world when it was first published back in 1997. Now, Four Letters of Love by Niall Williams has made it to the big screen with a stellar cast that includes Pierce Brosnan, Gabriel Byrne and Helena Bonham Carter. Never one to be typecast after she sizzled in the Tuscan fields in A Room with a View, Bonham Carter was determined not to be typecast, went on to feature in Fight Club, Planet of the Apes, the Harry Potter films, as well as playing the Queen Mother in The King's Speech and Princess Margaret in the TV series The Crown. Now, in this new film, Four Letters of Love, she plays an Irish woman, Margaret Gore, who's married to a poet called Murish. That poet is played by one Gabriel Byrne. They live on an island off the west coast. Their son is unwell after a seizure caused by an accident, while their daughter, Isabel, played by Anne Skelly, has fallen for a bit of an ne'er-do-well on the mainland, of course. But her head is turned when the son of a Dublin artist arrives on the island to source one of his father's paintings. I spoke with Helena Bonham Carter earlier about the film. Before we hear that conversation, here's a clip from Four Letters of Love featuring both Helena Bonham Carter and Gabriel Byrne. They're in bed chatting about their daughter Isabel, who came home unexpectedly.
She's home. Be happy.
But why would they let her home for 2 days?
Maybe they were disinfecting the place or something. It doesn't matter. She's home. That's all.
There's more to it. Do you hear me? Murish.
Well, sorry, darling. I must have fallen asleep. What is it, darling?
Nothing.
Nothing?
No, doesn't matter.
Right. Good night, Joe.
I don't know, with you, I feel something's happening.
Well, that would be probable.
You're useless. You're a completely useless man. You know that.
I do. Listen to me. Lord, how you worry. You worry when she's here. You worry when she's not here. That's what you do. That's how you love her.
Gabriel Byrne and Helena Bonham Carter there in a scene from Four Letters of Love. And Helena Bonham Carter, you are most welcome to Arena. What a joyous thing to get to do as a job, jump into bed with Gabriel Byrne and have a nice little party with him.
And get paid for it. It doesn't get better. I had my hot water bottles too, so I was really comfortable and I had my snacks. It is, you know, it is an absurdly fun and lucky job we have. And it was fun also. I mean, Gabriel, I had 3 weeks in with a man. He talks nonstop. It's all good chat. And in fact, most of Ireland talks, doesn't it? I mean, I love Ireland. It was just like, oh my God, you're all extroverts. And I had such fun chats. Everyone's so warm.
Yeah. We do talk. I think we do talk pretty well, I hope. You also had Pierce Brosnan there. Now, I know you didn't have, in terms of the film, you clearly wouldn't have had, I think you've little or no reaction with Pierce Brosnan's character. But I believe on the day you met the two of them, you were actually quite starstruck.
I know, my knees went, genuinely. I was like, oh God, I didn't think of this. Because, of course, when I was younger, they were like massive. I mean, they still are stars, but it was like, oh my God, I had crushes on them when I was younger. And it was like suddenly with them both in the trailer, I just was like, I can't meet them. And I just went, oh no, please, please. And then Polly pushed me in.
Polly.
Yeah. I just didn't know which one, but I was completely starstruck. And they're both really good looking and charming. So it's like, oh no. Anyway, I didn't really say much then, but I made up for it for the rest of the weeks.
Yeah. And it, the book itself then, on which the film is based, Helena, I think you have a long relationship with this book.
I love that book. It's like, I envy anyone who hasn't read it, who's going to read it. It's like they're in for a total beautiful and blissful adventure. And I fell in love with it. About 25 years ago, I read it. My mom gave me it. She'd read everything. She reads everything in the world. So this is the most special thing. And then it became my all-time favourite. And I wanted to try and get the rights and play Isabel. I would have been a slightly aged, I don't know, but I did look younger for my age then. And then nothing happened. Stanley Tucci bought it. Lots of people bought it and tried. But it's kind of an impossible thing to adapt until now.
Yeah, and it was Niall Williams himself who adapted it.
Yeah, he wrote it. The most beautiful script. It was like, you can't, it's just like most screenplays are quite dry. And this is poetry. And I just thought, the man's incapable of writing a normal sentence, you know, or a dull sentence or an unbeautiful one. And it was a beautiful thing. And I thought, oh, my God, this is like so much of the thing that the book itself is about, a predestiny and a fate and something that is a pattern that already is, you know, is there to be found and recognised. And I thought, oh, I just now, this is the, that's all coming out of the book and enthralling me into being part of it. So I was a total, what's the word? Shoo-in.
you were delighted when the call came. You play the character of Margaret Gore. Now you're at the point where you can play the mother. Isabel Gore, played by Anne Skelly, is one of the parts that was the part that when you first read the book you thought might be a runner for you at that point. Let's listen to a scene where, in fact, Margaret is giving Isabel some advice on how to make marriage work.
Right. I want you to listen to me and say nothing. When I met him, when he fell for me, your father, he said the poems wrote themselves. They poured out of him. And I took that as a sign. But when they stopped, that would have to be a sign too. I thought that love was poetry and moonlight. It's not. Falling in love, well, that's the easy part. The hard part is what follows. You have to make a marriage. The fact is, wives, they create their husbands. They begin with a blundering and well-meaning, sometimes charming, sometimes irresistible handsomeness they have fallen in love with, and that is fine. But then begins the work. That work is years long. Years. In my case, 36 years and counting. Years of hard labor to make the man I could live with.
Helena Bonham Carter there as Margaret Gore in Four Letters of Love. She's with me on the programme this evening. Years of hard labor to make the man I could live with. Do you agree with her when she gives that advice?
37 years. There has a lot to be said for training somebody up, you know. Making sure they put things away, don't, you know, leave the rubbish everywhere. Yeah, living with somebody is difficult. You might love them, but they can be, as oneself can be, basically antisocial at times. So one's got to bring an awareness of how to live with and love at the same time. It can be a tricky one.
Yeah. And it did also strike me, it's probably a few more years of hard labour to achieve the career that you have achieved and how difficult that is. We talked about Pierce Brosnan and Gabriel Byrne earlier on, who are still there working at full tilt, it would seem. Is it more difficult for a woman, do you think, to achieve that kind of longevity in her career? And how have you done it?
It's quite interesting. Yeah, I think there's more ageism with women, and there's more like, what do you look like? And that people are more less forgiving about women and age rather than with men. As sexual beings, I'd say. But I think that times are changing. I think with me, I've been drawn to character parts anyway, so I've sort of left off the hook a bit. So I wasn't that drawn to doing Ingenues. I was relieved, really relieved, when I didn't have to play them anymore.
Yeah, you'd forgive me, though, for mentioning the ingenue of them all, Lucy Honeychurch in Room with a View, because it did strike me that, if you like, Anne Skelly, who plays the part of Isabel, the young ingenue in Four Letters of Love, there are parallels, albeit very, very different worlds, you know, Italy and the travelling English.
Yeah.
Whereas here we have Ireland and the West Coast. But there are parallels there. Did you talk to Anne about that?
No. No, we didn't. We talked about the fact that Isabel, in a way, was the young Margaret before she all had her wildness and spontaneity stamped out of her by the sheer hard grind of her life. Mm. There's definitely a kindred spirit, those two. And then when I see her marrying Padder, and I go, oh no, she's marrying the wrong man, and it's like not even for enough love. It's deeply depressing, but
you have to trust, yeah. I suppose. You have to trust that love will win out at the end. One of the things that I think in terms of your career, if I might say it, the acting world has changed in recent times, the rise and rise of prestige television, and that, of course, brings us to The Crown and your role there as Princess Margaret. That particular series, I think, was for me, was a big landmark moment in the change in attitude towards television as opposed to film.
Yeah, I think it suddenly became, there was a lot of respect given to television suddenly because of the art form of the television, you know, with the streaming. It was a dream for writers, and with episodes, a great dream for actors, because you had the breadth in which to develop a character, and having an ongoing cast of characters and seeing how they develop over years. Mm-hmm. So the quality of television has been never better and that was afforded by the arrival of the streaming.
Yeah. And of course, you're no stranger to the royals. You also played the Queen Mother in The King's Speech in the film. Any particular qualities or any particular style of acting that you can use when you're playing a royal? How do you get a royal right?
That's a good thing. Well, we had an amazing teacher, Polly Bennett, who did a lot of behavioural stuff with us on Crown. And one good clue was absolutely crucial, is slow down. If you're playing a royal, you have to slow the hell down, because they practically move in slow motion. And a lot of it is because their soul, one of their big raison d'etre, is to be seen. So if you're getting out of a car and you're going to open a supermarket or something, the slower you are getting out of the car and onto the pavement and into the door, the more people will see you.
Do you know, not bad advice. Not bad advice for a screen actor, that either, is it?
Yeah, it was difficult to be, yes, but at the same time, you could be pretty predictable and boring. but definitely the Queen, one of the lady-in-waitings, Anne, Glen Connor, advised me that said, like with Margaret, even when not in public, she was slow and deliberate. So it would drive her up the wall. Like it was like this slow motion turn. And because also she had the status to be able to make people wait. I mean, I learned a lot about also this sort of, I used to always think, why do they always look the same? You know, wouldn't you want to change it up and what you look like? And of course, they weren't allowed to.
No.
You had to have a recognizable silhouette, and that was it. And Margaret was tiny. She was about just 5 feet. And so she had her chair and her car raised so they could see her. And a lot of Margaret with her head, was trying to be as conspicuous as she could, given how tiny she was.
Yeah. Well, you haven't been slow in other roles. I'm thinking of Bellatrix in Harry Potter, who certainly flew around the place at quite a lick. And Margaret, it has to be said. Margaret, in Four Letters of Love. She paces up and down that village at quite a rate several times.
Oh, I'm running all the time. I mean, she's running the household. She's keeping the world going. She keeps the whole of that little world of the household going. She's a domestic Atlas, so there's nothing that she's not doing. There's always a ton of jobs to be done. This is exactly what I'm not at home.
Well, we will play...
The domestic spa, yeah. But I really get domestic when on set,
Well, right place to do it.
Cooking, everything, yeah.
Let somebody else do it at home. That's the way to behave. Well, I'm going to finish up with a domestic scene, actually, from Four Letters of Love, Helena, where you say very little, but you're watching everything here. Anne Skelly as Isabel Gore at this stage we can pretty much take it for granted that she's fallen in love with Fionn O'Shea's Nicholas Coughlan, and the whole family are gathered around having a bit of a dinner, and there's a little bit of talking and looking between Gabriel Byrne as Muirish Gore and yourself, Helena Bonham Carter, as Margaret Gore. We'll finish with that. Thank you so much for being with us on Arena, Helena.
You're very welcome.
And here is our clip from Four Letters of Love.
I tell you, where's the mother?
Oh, God, your father's gone blind.
I could not breathe when you sat at the dinner table and touched my hand. I could not think.
I remembered us then. Did you?
If there are moments on which lives turn, I knew this was one of mine.
Once it's inside you, it's inside you forever.
But that I would fail it.
Do you play, Nicholas? Or do you paint like your father?
Oh, Nicholas reads poetry.
Oh?
What? He told me.
Is that right?
I want to thank you both for your kindness. I'm going to go.
Well, you can't go, because there's no ferry until tomorrow.
Well, don't look so disappointed. It might hurt my feelings.
Anna Skelly there as Isabel Gore. Before that, you heard Donal Finn, who plays the character of Sean Gore, her brother. Gabriel Byrne was at the table. Helena Bonham Carter was at the table, not saying very much, but watching everything. And the voiceover then provided by Fionn O'Shea in the character of Nicholas Coughlan. He is the painter's son, as you might have picked up from that clip. I was going to say Four Weddings and a Funeral. Four Letters of Love is the title of the film, and it will be in Irish cinemas this weekend. You're listening to Monday Night's Arena. Writer Enda Walsh has been collaborating with Paul Fahey, the artistic director of the Galway International Arts Festival, on the festival's immersive theatre installations, or rooms, for over a decade now. He said he wants to keep making them until the day he dies. There's been a dining room, there's been a girl's bedroom, there's been a waiting room, and this year there is the baby's room. All of these installations last for around 13, 14 minutes, and for many festival attendees, an essential part of their Galway experience. Delighted that Enda Walsh joins me now from Galway. They really are something that have become so much part of the festival every July. And had you any idea when yourself and Paul started? I think it was 2014, maybe the first one was Room 303?
Yeah, 12 years ago. This is our 12th one this year.
Right, yeah. Had you any idea back then that it was going to grow into this?
Well, you know, the initial idea was Paul's idea, because he knew that I'd written this piece, Room 303, and we were going to do it in a very tiny room, but not a room where people would just come in and it would be on a sort of a tape, and they could sort of hit a tape and listen to it, literally that simple. And Paul goes, let's build a hotel room in a white box. And I said, oh, amazing. And then we did it. And I could see it sort of like, you know, there's five people that can go into these rooms at a time. And so the first experience of it 12 years ago, I thought, oh my God, this is amazing. These voices feel really confessional and, you know, obviously private. And you're in a space where this person has been, or maybe they're about to sort of like get to or whatever. And also, like, they can be set in any time, really. And so as soon as we did that, I said, oh, we should actually do one. We should do one again. We did it as a sort of second year. And then since then, I thought, no, actually, I should keep on doing it. There's something incredibly strong about it.
And you foolishly said to somebody somewhere, I want to do one of these every year until I die.
I will. I mean, hopefully someone's going to stop producing me at some stage. But I'm going to sort of carry on and actually sort of write one every year. It's a real, for me, it's a real touchstone. You know, back when I was a kid, like sort of 16 and starting to write and write stories and whatever, and write from the first person, they were like, you know, stories for me were all about sort of getting to know character and, you know, strangers. And this is really a right back to, you know, to that time. And also when they're just sort of language based, there's no, well, there is a little bit of sort of structure, sort of, you know, trickery involved sometimes, but usually it's just character and language.
Yeah. So what the person or the people going into the room get is they're in this about size of an average room, about 5 meters by 5 meters. And there are all the accoutrements that would be in such a room, be it an hotel room or a bathroom or a girl's bedroom, as you had, or the waiting room, I think, was one of the ones that I saw in recent years. All the accoutrements, all the things that would be in those rooms, and you're hearing this voiceover of a person telling you a part, like an event or some very specific moment in their lives. But I'm interested in the nature of the room and the space itself. I mean, it's a confined space. It's just the one. It's just the one voice. That confinement, that physical confinement of the room.
Yeah.
How does it for you? How does it mirror maybe the psychological confinement of the characters and the space that they're in? And how do the two things feed off each other?
Well, everyone knows at this stage my obsession with interiors. I mean, it's sort of like, I mean, it probably comes from when I was a little bit of a kid and, you know, and that feeling of really sort of claustrophobia, but also a slight fear of the outside also. So they're very sort of charged spaces. And yes, it's the relationship that the person has with, I mean, I'll walk into any old room, Sean, and sort of I will sit there and I'll feel, I mean, you know, it's one of the sort of, you know, superpowers of a playwright, if you can have one, is that actually I can sense sort of a vibe very strongly. And it's that very simple idea that sort of like the walls hold voices and ghosts. And it's literally as simple as that. For some reason, it's sort of like, I mean, it was a great idea of Paul's, and I've just sort of hopped on it and sort of ran with it, and we both have, you know.
And that idea of a room as an inspirational space, the way you've just described it.
Yeah.
I mean, do you find yourself literally going into friends' houses or other places and saying, oh, here's a possibility for
room?
Well,
you know, I guess also that I'm really sort of obsessed with details and what people sort of do to their rooms, and your character is being presented in this sort of like, you know, in furniture or detail or whatever. And my dad was in this furniture business, so there's a little bit of that there.
Oh, right.
And, you know, they're very sort of evocative spaces. This year, it's like a baby's room, so it's a nursery. So when you walk in, it's like a cot, and in a very sort of small nursery room with three, you know, nursery-type paintings on the wall. And over the sort of course of the 14 minutes, you hear this 33-year-old woman trying to get back to the point of when she was a baby, and she just replays her life in reverse. Very, very fast, and voiced by Kate Gilmore brilliantly. But it's just like, I become obsessed with people's voices as well, and actors' voices. So I did like a safe house with Kate last year, and I loved the way she talked when, you know, like when we were sort of like, you know, in rehearsals, the speed of her thought. I thought, oh my God, her brain works so fast. So I just wrote her this piece because I wanted to sort of, you know, test her voice, really.
Yeah, because I have a memory, and I don't know what year or what particular room we may or may not have been talking about at the time. But I remember you saying to me about how important that the particular actor would be to the realization of this character, that you would quite often have a very specific voice in mind. I mean,
all of them. I mean, but it's sort of like, you know, it's sort of Marty Ray or Ruth McCabe or sort of Rory Nolan or sort of any of these people, Eileen Walsh, it's sort of like, I've been really fortunate that I've worked with really great actors, but it's, yeah, it's you begin really with their voice, I do, and then I just start thinking about rooms. I start thinking about interiors and stuff like that. And also people pitch me ideas because people have sort of become obsessed with them and they go, you should really do a shed. Why haven't you done a shed? All this sort of stuff, you know, like it's, yeah. So well, I think I've filled a house. I'm now sort of breaking out a house into other places.
Well, I want to hear that voice and that character that you just gave us. I want to hear about his shed. I'm a bit worried about what's going on in it, but...
It's fine.
I hear next year's room already in creation. I'm wondering about the nature of the writing. I mean, obviously, you know, you're writing all the time, and you're writing plays, you're writing screenplays, you're involved in all kinds of projects, as we know. Is this something that fits into a particular time of the year when you go, oh, yes. better start thinking about Paul will be on to me soon saying, what room are we doing?
Everything has to be really timetabled with me. So it is March. I think it's the second week of March. So I'll think about it and I'll start thinking about it in February when I'm walking the dog. And then I'll write it over 5 days and it'll be written. I'll write it in a week. And then I'll send it to Paul and then we'll talk about it. And then like it goes to the sound designer. Or no, we'll report and then it goes to the sound designer. She works on it for a couple of weeks. So it always happens at the same time, the same period every year.
That's extraordinary that you write it in 5 days. I mean, I know it's 14, 15 minutes long is what you're talking about.
Yeah.
At the outset, but to write a short piece, it can often be a lot more difficult than to write a long piece.
It can, but it's sort of like, yeah, I'm so used to doing them now. I know the attack of them and the various sort of expression of them and the potential sort of structure of them. I mean, I do keep a few of them in my head through the year, you know, like, and then I'm ready to sort of write when I think of the actor then, you know, like whatever, and it's all of that. I'm ready to write it.
Yeah, so it's not as if in February you say, oh, what am I going to do this year? There's probably something bubbling along there in the background.
Yeah, you get a sense of the rhythm and the tone of it and the world of it and whether it's comic or sort of completely not or whatever it is.
But I'm thinking about, in some ways, you know, there is a sparseness to just one voice and, you know, probably it's a very kind of specific, it's like the arc of a short story in some ways. It's the top of the arc. It's a very specific moment in it. And I'm thinking, you know, because obviously one of the most recent adaptations for the screen was Small Things Like These from Claire Keegan. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a woman who knows how to write spare prose. Was the adaptation of that easier because of the sparseness of Claire's writing?
Yes. Well, yes and no. It's sort of like because she's the sort of master of tone, really. And really what the, you know, she writes, as you say, sort of like in this sort of minimalist sort of like way, but everything is completely correct. So really you have to sort of like lean into the sort of subtext of it, as she does, and sort of allow it sort of happen. And it's also the placement of the audience, the placement of the reader in the piece. You have to sort of give them enough space to imagine and feel it. And sometimes words and too many words and, you know, can actually sort of, as you know, can actually kill something. They can sort of like, they can over-explain it. And you know, like, I don't know, they can squash your own sort of feelings and imagination about the piece.
Yeah,
because she just opens it up to you.
Yeah, and she somehow seems to leave loads of space between every word on the page, however she manages that. But I've heard you speak again in previous times about this idea of one of the things that has always attracted you to theatre, for example, and to playwriting, is the fact that you can have a silence on the stage. And a silence on radio is deadly, but a silence on the stage can be an absolutely wonderful thing.
Yeah, it's always about sort of like, I mean, God, I hate myself for saying this, and you know, like, you know, I sound so pretentious, but a lot of the time when I talk to the team about the work that I've worked with for years and years and years, a lot of it is actually just sort of charging that sort of that big silent space with noise and expression and rhythm and, you know, like loudness. But really you want to take all that away and hit these vast moments of sort of like of space, and you know, and you're constantly playing with that. You're also throwing sort of words and or images or noise or sort of physical comedy or whatever it is into this thing, only to really sort of take it away and see what's left of the character. You know, there's a lot of that, and these rooms have a similar sort of power in many ways. It's the same. It's the same sort of, although they're like, they're tiny, they're small, and also their audio. It's the same sort of thing. It's always about, like, you know, what isn't being said a lot of the time, and, you know, and also just the wild expression of that character. Why are they talking the way they are? All that sort of thing. And the fact that, of course, they're really ephemeral. They're over. They're over as soon as they sort of started, which I just love. You know.
And have you ever been tempted? I think more. There's maybe only one. And for those who haven't seen it, we don't even need to go there. I think there's only one that you couldn't revisit. But I think most of them, could you revisit them? Have you ever thought about revisiting one of the characters in a different room, or to see how the room has been renovated a few years off?
I haven't, but that's a really, really excellent idea. That's a really good idea. I'll take that. And I'll make it my own.
I thought of this.
But that is a very good idea. Do you know what, Sean? At one point, though, I did, like, you know, that, like, a while ago, like, at the very, very beginning, actually, in fairness, that I thought, oh, yeah, of course, I'll get around to knitting them all together at some stage.
Oh, yeah.
And then I thought, no, because actually, sort of, people don't work like that, really. I mean, to be honest about it, it is that thing. You know, I love Hitchcock's Rear Window and all of that. That lives, sort of, like, watching all those lives.
Yeah.
Sort of at the same time, you know, like sort of existing. And my dream always was like, and it was like going, okay, I'm going to die, but I'm going to continue to make these.
Dreams.
And the idea of sort of like, you know, walking into a giant gymnasium with sort of like 35, 40 rooms sort of existing at the same time is a very, very, very true representation of what goes on in my head all the bloody time. And I thought, well, that's fantastic. That would be... That'll be my tombstone.
Yeah. You want a giant gymnasium with 35 or 40 rooms in it.
But it'll be fine.
Yeah. Again, you know, you mentioned some of the names there. Niall Boggy was there, Charlie Murphy, Eileen Reid,
yeah.
Paul Reed, Donal O'Kelly, Aoife Duffy. I mean, it's a wonderful list of Irish actors. But am I right in thinking the guy with whom you've collaborated the longest, one could argue, your great pal,
Killian.
Yeah, has Killian true. Murphy ever done one of them? No?
No, he hasn't. That's so, I mean, he hasn't. I mean, he hasn't. That was very strange. I mean, he is busy, in fairness. But,
yeah, he's a few things.
I mean,
on his
I
plate.
Am around him quite often, but yeah, that's really strange.
Yeah,
maybe I'll knock on his door. I should write. God knows what.
Yeah, and you did mention the idea of putting a load of the rooms together. That has happened in the past. I think five of them went to the Barbican at one stage, and they have travelled around the world in different ways.
Yeah, I would love to bring them to Dublin. I would love to sort of like, you know, to, they're sort of, I would love to, it's because it's an amazing experience to watch sort of five of them at the same time,
yeah.
Or to go in and out of them. There's something happens to, you know, like it's an unusual sort of experience.
Yeah, I've seen
it. It's sort of like it's falling into a short story again and again and again, a different one all the time.
Yeah, or a collection of short stories, the way we do, you know, that you might read them in whatever order. And I've seen a couple of them, and I'd love to see a few more together, and maybe ones that I never had a chance to see.
Yeah,
you know, it would be a great thing. Anyway, listen, best of luck with it all.
I know you'll have to wait until I die. Yeah, Sean, that's it. I promise to die before you.
Then I have to outlive you, and only one of us will know if that has happened. thanks so much for being with us this evening, Enda.
Okay, lots of love.
Enda Walsh, lots of love right back to you, Enda. Yeah, don't know which of us is going to die first. At any rate, the baby's room that Enda was telling us about there starts at run. It's run this very day, July the 14th. It'll be there through until the 27th. Today, of course, is the day one of Galway International Arts Festival 2025. But if you want to find out full details of the baby's room and how that all works, it's taking place in the Bailey Allen Hall in the University of Galway. It runs every 20 minutes, starts at 11 in the morning, goes through until 6 in the evening, Sunday to Wednesday, slightly different on 11 a.m. to 8 p.m. Thursday to Saturday, so it's a very busy week. You do need to book tickets, they're very hard to get. GIAF.ie will give you all of the details. Rose Keating is already the winner of the Marion Keyes Young Writer Award and the Sean Dunn Young Writers Award, and has just published her debut title, Odd Body, a collection of short stories that investigate the horrors and absurdities of the feminine experience. And delighted that Rose joins us now on the line. I mentioned some of the prizes there, and it's quite a long list for a comparatively new writer, Rose. What kind of encouragement does that give you you know, heading off into the big bad world of publishing and hoping to write books on a regular basis?
Oh, geez, I don't even know. I mostly just think of it as getting very lucky, to be honest with you.
So you're going to write anyway, whether you win the awards or not. That's what that's what you're saying. That suggests you have to do it. Odd Body, a collection of short stories. Let's talk a little bit about the title story, if we could, Rose. This is a woman being haunted by a ghost who I kind of think is pleasant, but then some of the things that the ghost is suggesting are not so pleasant. But the character is certainly in a bit of a bind in her, if that's her supernatural life or whatever that ghost represents. In her real life, there seems to be an awful lot of pretty nasty stuff going on, courtesy of a rather nasty boyfriend, it has to be said.
Mm.
Tell us about him.
Of course, yeah. I mean, for me, you know, with that story, I'm interested in the fact that you think he's nasty. I do think he's not pleasant at all. But it was kind of hard to write him because I didn't want him to be unrealistically nasty. He's just, he's not a caring person. And I think that's a big part of this story, is a lack of care, both inward in herself and, you know, outward from the world she's experiencing. There's very little love or tenderness or care. And this ghost, like, it, even though it's quite harmful, it does offer a kind of familiar feeling of at least tenderness, a harmful kind of tenderness, you know?
Yeah, I'll defend my use of the word nasty, so as opposed to your not pleasant. When somebody is kind of controlling, as it seems to me, this chap seems to be doing, controlling the receiver of the texts in when he sends the texts and when he'll respond to a text and when he won't respond to a text, it comes across as not pleasant or nasty or both, perhaps.
Yeah, you know what? To be fair, in hindsight, he's not the nicest fella in the world, no.
And that used to mean the use and non-use of social media, I suppose it very much is part of the current generation. So much communication or non-communication or coercive communication happens in that way. Is it easier, do you think, to behave in a not pleasant way when you have the anonymity, not quite anonymity, but when you have the distance of just sending a text?
Oh, I completely think so. And I think you said a great word there, control. I feel like so much of like in-person communication, you lose control so quickly, or there's a fluidity to it where you can't really think about what you're saying. Well, you can, but you don't have that time to plan and to orchestrate. Even Dearin herself, we have that passage where, you know, she writes down the text first and then she redrafts it and then it's in her notes app. There's so much control in both of the characters where there's very little like organic fluidity that would allow for, you know, true intimacy. So much of it is orchestrated. And that's so much a part of, you know, technological communication as opposed to like real life, intimate, true communication.
Yeah, because you can't go back and delete what you just said and re-say it in a new way when you found a more precise way of doing it. But I guess then the writing of a text, even though we often dismiss it as, you know, swift communication, etc., or the tweet, I suppose, more, even more so in that respect, can't be that different from the writing of a short story. I doubt very much, Rose, that you sat down and started writing the first line of each story and out fell all of the other lines and it was all very simple. I'm guessing there's a lot of rewriting and correcting to be done there too to get that precision.
My God, yes. Like, even when I tell people, you know, how long does it take to, you know, write a whole story? Like, theoretically, it's like, oh yeah, I did the first draft in a day or two and it sounds really cool. But then it's like the months and months of going back and editing and then going back in a year's time later, you know, and then saying, oh my God, I need to do this all over again. And it just feels like genuinely you're never quite finished, but at a certain point you just have to stop because you just drive yourself mad, you know?
Yeah, I heard the tiredness in your "my God, yes," which was a spontaneous response to my question. Tell me a little bit more then about this idea of the ghost. And while I was saying the ghost seems to be pleasant enough and certainly supportive in some ways, but there are hints within, I don't want to give too much, but certainly the ghost is hinting that the best way to deal with all of this is to end it all.
Yeah, I think that's that's kind of the tricky thing with this ghost is, because even when I was coming about, like trying to figure out how to redraft it and how to edit it, the kind of the ghost's goal kept coming up over and over again as to whether the ghost is, does the ghost actually care for Darren? Is he trying to hurt her? And it's kind of hard because I think he both does care for her deeply and does want to harm her, but he does not view it as a harmful thing. It's this terrible act that he wants her to commit is an act of love in his eyes, which is, I mean, obviously the story could be analyzed, you know, however you want, but it's that perspective of this is genuinely being framed as a valid, true argument from the point of view of the ghost and from Darren to a certain extent, because she understands what the ghost wants. She does not see him as a bad, a bad presence. He's not that bad of a ghost. You know, he's her friend. He loves her.
Yeah, and it's you're quite definite that the ghost is a he in the way you're framing it and saying it me there. No question in your mind about that. And no question when you're reading it. I mean, I felt he was a he as well when I was reading along. But I wonder to what extent, and you may or may not have analysed this to this degree, is that something within Darren, who's the lead character of the story, is it something within her mind, or is it something that you feel is as real as the not pleasant boyfriend, Ben?
I feel terrible for saying he now. I mean, it's such a point in the story of trying to make it a genderless ghost, like, but revealed it all now. But yeah, with the in terms of the realism, that was a tricky thing. I think in a lot of the stories, I struggle very much. Maybe struggle is the wrong word, but the goal for every story is to kind of reach a point of balance where it is both not real, it's a metaphor, it's an idea, it's abstract, but also simultaneously trying to make it completely true, completely an actual reality. Like this isn't make-believe, this isn't a dream, and trying to basically achieve both of those things simultaneously, which is very, it's tricky to do, to kind of get that balance. But in this story, I did want it to be like, yeah, the ghost can be a metaphor, but the ghost is real. Yeah. Like there are things that Darren doesn't even understand about the ghost, like where it goes at night, what its real purpose is, you know, how even the science of it works, I think almost adds to the fact that this is like a real thing that she doesn't understand in the same way that I don't understand, I don't know, I don't even know how gravity works, you know, but it's real.
Well, I mean, there's another, I just go to another story where, to my mind, there was no question about whether this is real or not real. And there wasn't much question in my mind for the Odd Body story either. So, yeah, well, that ghost is there telling her things. That's fine. I can take that. Next to Cleanliness is the story that I'm thinking of. And of course, Godliness is next to Cleanliness. This is about a character called Catherine, who's undergoing cleansing treatments to such an extent that things start to go very wrong, in fact, for her. Is it Dr. Matthews who is treating Catherine?
Oh, yeah. Terrible Dr. Matthews.
This does sound like, I mean, there's some, turn on Google now and you're going to come across probably something suggesting here's something you could do that will clean up your life and that will give you a better lifestyle. You know, if you drink this wonderful green kale smoothie, you'll be perfect. Your health will be perfect. Was that kind of online encouragement or online kind of nudging you in certain directions? Was that part of what you were looking at in this story?
Oh, completely. I mean, I think I wrote this one probably a little bit after New Year's, a good few years ago. And obviously, you know, after New Year's, that's just, it's everywhere, isn't it? But also, it had been at the back of my mind for a while. Like, yeah, there's that whole side of it where it's like very much like physical health and physical wellness and that pressure to, you know, be perfect and look good, etc. But even then, the more I thought about it, so much of even that, the physical health ties into the idea of just like well-being and happiness and once you do this one thing, you know, you'll finally be correct and clean and good. And it almost comes to the point where like unhappiness, like sadness becomes unhealthiness or sickness, which I don't think is true. I think sadness is very natural and normal. But with that kind of rhetoric, it so quickly becomes sadness as something that is wrong in you that needs to be removed, which is horrifying because removing that is removing personhood, is removing, you know, your completeness. It makes you a little bit... It does something, the act of trying to remove your personhood can create a wrongness in yourself, which, you know, spoilers, but I'd imagine in the story you can see that Catherine doesn't do too well when that when that is attempted.
Yeah, and it does strike me, and there are other characters, and a lot of the protagonists here are young females who seem to be, if not in a situation of shame, They're being made feel shame for not feeling shame, but they're being made feel shame about trying to be who they want to be themselves. That obviously was something that was preying on your mind quite a lot.
Oh, completely. I mean, I think a running theme in the collection, which I probably wouldn't have, it wasn't even conscious as you're going, but like in hindsight, when I look back, is characters who just experience a feeling of like wrongness within themselves and then within the world, because they're all strange worlds. But like the strangest thing is, I mean, the inside of these women, their own kind of brains and trying to navigate these worlds where they're told they do not fit in or there's something incorrect about them that needs to be fixed, you know, and that they don't feel bad about, or, you know, the shame of feeling ashamed is like this reoccurring thing that it's, they're not even allowed to experience that negativity because that's a thing that needs to be corrected.
And I was interested then to read something you, as part of a Writer's Digest blog or interview that you had taken part in. And you said yourself, I often stopped mid-draft and felt I should delete what I had written if I'd said something too ugly or too pathetic or too shameful. So you actually, did you find yourself second-guessing yourself as a writer, and how difficult was it to overcome that? I have to write this no matter what somebody else thinks about it.
Oh, it's so difficult. To be honest, no, I don't even know if I have overcome it. Like, even it's just past launch week now, and whenever I think of, you know, family or friends and stuff reading it, it's tough, you know, because it's not like anything in this collection is shameful or bad, but it's hard because I think being very truthful can be a little bit pathetic, but it's also, patheticness is kind of inherent in our humanness, and you just kind of have to be okay with allowing people to see you as a whole, or see even your thoughts and your art as a whole. It's vulnerable, I think, but I'd rather, as I said in that article, like tell the truth about my understanding of being a person than, you know, create some false thing that's, you know, that's just not truthful or real.
Yeah, well, I would say to you, you're saying it's, sometimes it's pathetic to be, you know, to be so truthful. It's pathetic not to be truthful too, you know, so give yourself a break on that one. Finally, if I could, how big a Bela Lugosi fan are you? Because there's a story called Bela Lugosi Isn't Dead, and there's another kind of horror film story. I wondered, were you a big horror fan? Did you watch Bela Lugosi in Dracula quite a lot as a teenager, as one of these characters does?
Do you know what? I am a huge horror fan and a huge Dracula fan. That story is a bit funny, though, because I did used to rewatch horror films, especially from a very young age, like 11 or 12, over and over again, but it wasn't Dracula, it was Silence of the Lambs, and I thought that was too weird. So I edited it to Dracula because it just felt a little bit more, you know, vampires are kind of teenagey. That's, you know, that's a little more acceptable.
Were you ashamed?
The Hannibal thing was too weird.
Were you ashamed of liking Silence of the Lambs?
Like, very much. I had a little crush on Anthony Hopkins, I think, and I have to repress that now forever.
Yes, that may be something you might regret saying. No. But it was on Anthony Hopkins as opposed to Hannibal Lecter, was it?
I think so. He just got such a nice accent, you know.
Listen, lovely to have spoken with you, Rose. And congratulations on the debut collection. Continued success to you. That is Rose Keating speaking to us about her debut collection, which is called Odd Body. And it is published by Canongate. And that is our lot for this Monday evening. Leah Murphy researched. Dolly Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Pather Carney was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sheila O'Callaghan. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.